Pearsland, welcome again to ABC Classic FM.
Thank you so much, John.
You're off stage. You've just played Mozart, a wonderful work, a work which Mozart himself referred to as one of the best he'd ever written. What memories does it have for you? How far back into your musical life does it go?
Well, it goes a long way back, actually. I did my final chamber music exam at the Queensland Conservatorium of Music playing this Mozart quintet, and the bassoonist on that occasion was Matthew Wilkie, who's a rather famous international bassoonist these days too, and so we did our chamber music exam together, and that was 1978, I think. So
I wasn't going to ask you dates, but it's a work that's lived alongside you, really, through the better part of your professional life, nearly all of it. I guess a work like that is something you do come to know and love. It's the repetition of performances that makes it reveal itself to you? Is that
it's
a reasonable question?
Different every time. It depends on the players you're with. It depends on the piano you have. It depends on the acoustic. It depends on the audience. You know, it's always a different experience. And that's the great thing with these classic works. They always have more to give you than you can bring to them. You know, as you develop, you see more and more.
I guess that's how they sustain their value, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes. Piers, you're exceptionally busy on this tour to Australia. Not so long ago, only a couple of weeks ago, we heard you live on ABC Classic FM playing the Chopin Nocturnes. And I believe that you, not so long ago, played those Nocturnes on a Pleyel piano, Chopin's own.
That's right. Yes, I started playing the complete Nocturnes last year. It was the bicentenary of Chopin's birthday. And there are two birthdays celebrated for Chopin, late February 1, the 27th, and then March the 1st. Chopin and his mother always said he was born in March, but the records say February the 27th, and you didn't have to fill in records as soon as your baby was born in those times. You know, it could be a long time afterwards, so there's this discrepancy. And so I think to compensate for that, Warsaw last year had non-stop concerts for 5 days or something through the night and all the rest of it. But I played for the Chopin Society of London all of the Nocturnes by candlelight in the Actors' Church, St. Paul's in Covent Garden, and it was filled to overflowing. And so that put the thought in my head, oh, perhaps other people would like this as well. And in fact, now I've done them quite a few times at the wonderful Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, and did them in Canada. I've done them in quite a lot of places. Did them in Sydney earlier this year in Angel Place, and now, of course, just recently in the Melbourne Recital Centre, again with candlelight, which adds special atmosphere and helps transport you back to those times, I think.
Is this another case where living with, in this case, works rather than one, which is what we were chatting about with Mozart, there's something comes out of them further and further, more and more out of them each time?
Unquestionably. Mm. Funnily enough, the one I learned first of the Nocturnes was the last one, the E major opus 62, which is the most elusive one in many ways, but it was down for a Brisbane to Stanford or something when I was a child. It was in a quick study section, actually. Only two of us entered for it. And so I learned it then and didn't understand it at all, of course. Still seeking understanding of that piece. It's a weird one, wonderful one, though. And written at the end of Chopin's life. That's the lovely thing. When you do a set of works like that, you go on a voyage, you know, and you're starting at Opus 9, the famous E-flat, which everybody knows and we hear it on mobile phones, and then end up at Opus 62, a totally different world. And you think Chopin was only 39 when he died. Where would he have gone after that? Maybe he'd have gone where Debussy went, because you see big influences of Chopin in Debussy and lots of other people, of course.
Absolutely. It's easy to be deceived by the poetic writing, perhaps, in Chopin, the melodiousness, the swooning, but they're highly intelligent works.
Oh, and extraordinarily adventurous harmonically.
Mm. Mm. Yes, there are plenty of examples in the preludes and other sets of works. Amazing composer, really, for looking forward, I suppose it's fair to say, to Liszt.
Well, Liszt was concurrent as well, of course, and yes, fascinating. In the festival up in Townsville this year, the Australian Festival of Chamber Music, we're having an afternoon session on the first Sunday, written by Jessica Duchin, a friend of mine in London, who's a novelist and a music critic. And she's written about the relationship between Liszt and Wagner. And, you know, Liszt foretold so many developments. And one of them was the Tristan chord, for which Wagner is so famous.
Yes.
And that'll become obvious in that afternoon too. We'll hear a bit of the song from which it came. But he also was a prophet for Bartok. I mean, the Chartus Macabre and late works like that sound like Bartok. Jadot à la Villa d'Este is a pre-runner for Ravel's Jadot. And so many different composers find roots in Liszt.
Testing tonality, the Bagatelle without tonality,
yes,
the Weerkrucz's whole tone scales.
That's right, the Faust Symphony has a serial scale
it
in it. And so Liszt was extraordinary as well. So, of course, he and Chopin influenced each other, but They were pretty amazing, both of them.
I always have visions of Cosimo leaning out one of the sort of wet area windows at the house in Bayreuth and saying hello to Frank walking past on his morning walk in the morning. It's very intimate and possible when you go to a place like Bayreuth and see where these people live.
I've been to Noant as well, of course, George Sand's house, where Chopin spent many productive summers.
Tell me, before we get too far from Chopin, about that play or piano and the Cobb collection.
Sorry, yes. Alex Cobb has this marvellous place, Hurstwood Farm, just south of London, and a huge collection that has Haydn's last piano and a clavichord that might have been played by Bach and Ravel's piano, Mahler's piano, fascinating things. Two pianos that were prepared for Chopin. He only owned two pianos in his life, and this one was purchased in 1848 for his last concerts in Paris, and then when he went to England later that year. And I played all of the nocturnes on that piano too, on Chopin's own piano. You know, they talk about 6 degrees of separation, but here's a bit of his
anything
DNO, hopefully.
Revealing, tell you anything about the works?
Absolutely. Mm. It made me play them differently. Mm-hmm. It made me slow certain things down, actually, to make the piano sing. And the piano had extraordinary range. I was expecting quite a small sound, really, but it's big in a different sort of way. And an easier action, of course, and playing cadenzas, the decorations, those were the things that I wanted to play slower and just really appreciate the melodic shapes more. So, it taught me a lot, actually.
And Cobb, at the house that Cobb owns with his collection, there is something of an Australian connection, you tell me.
There is. He's got an amazing room in the middle of this giant place. Actually, I don't think he does own it. It's the National Trust, but they let him hire it, I suppose. And aside from an amazing collection of instruments and of paintings, he has this room with Australiana, because he comes from an aristocratic Irish family whose maid married the doctor from Captain Cook's second trip to Australia. And they've got a fantastic collection of 18th century boomerangs and bones of animals and animals and birds and insects and things. Lots from Australia and some from New Zealand as well. So I felt very
makes me wonder what had happened to the collection of Australian animals that the Empress Josephine had at Malmaison in Paris. She had kangaroos and wombats, all sorts of things. Amazing, isn't it? We started talking about how busy you are on this trip, and your next destination is Townsville for the Chamber Music Festival. I have had some intimate involvement with the Chamber Music Festival sometime. It's a huge project to put together, isn't it?
Tell me about it. Yes, I don't think it's a day in the year goes by that I'm not thinking about it in some form or another. And quite a few calls at sort of 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. in the morning from London to the office in Townsville to wonderful general manager up there now, Sue Hackett. And I'm already planning next year. I've got to think about next week, but sort of thinking about next year and bits about the following year as well. You're always planning ahead. And at the moment, Alicia in the office is trying to sort out the rehearsal schedule. You can imagine the sort of crossword puzzle that is.
Yes.
Massive nightmare.
It's a chicken or egg question, but do you think artists or program first?
I have to start out with artists, actually, because they have to be booked, of course, plenty of time in advance. And I suppose it could be considered a lazy way out for a director, but part of the programming is based on anniversaries. And I think that brings forth some interesting things. I mean, we're looking at Liszt from a different point of view. You don't hear much Liszt chamber music. We're hearing the piano trio Tristia, and we're hearing some violin works and so on, and thinking about him in relation to Wagner. And also looking at Percy Grainger. Well, Percy still doesn't get enough airtime,
I don't think.
You know, I think no one does joy better than Percy Grainger, and he's such an honest, open man and composer. So we've got quite a lot of Grainger, and I've got the Cantiguglia twins from New York coming. They're in their early 70s, and they have played together, I think, every day of their lives. They live in the same building in New York, and they're an extraordinary duo, you know, immaculate duo. And they've recorded all of Grainger and Liszt's two piano works, so I had to have them this year. And they were students of Dame Myra Hess, and I have a big association with her. She was a sort of I'm a grand student of hers in a way, through Yonti Solomon, who was one of her very few students. And I do a show with Patricia Routledge based on Myra Hess and the wartime legendary series she created at
Which
the National
part do you
Gallery.
Play?
I play the music. But it's amazing. It came about because I started a Myra Hess Day at the National Gallery 5 years ago, and a friend was sitting there and looked up and saw Dame Myra in the audience, which was a bit startling because she died in 1965. And then he realised it was Patricia Routledge, of Mrs. Bouquet fame, of course. And that sowed the seed in my head. And I thought, oh. And when I met Patricia Routledge, I said, would you ever consider portraying Dame Myra in some way? And she you know, she was open to the idea.
Did she remember her from concerts?
She certainly did. Mm. She was one of the first great pianists she heard when she was growing up near Liverpool, and she was taken to Philharmonic Hall to hear her. So, yes, and she adores playing Myra. She doesn't play her. She reads Myra's letters and interviews. It's all put together beautifully by Dame Myra's great-nephew, Nigel Hess, who's quite a famous film composer. And we had marvellous sessions where Patricia and Nigel and I, with Chris Luscombe, the director, got together, and we went through every phrase and every word and edited it all, and we were all on the same wavelength, and these lunchtime sessions turned into sort of six-hour marathons discussing words, which was just lovely.
I'd like to explore a little further, really, the musicians that are at Sounds Book.
Yes, well, who else have we got coming this year? Rivka Golani.
Yes.
Fabulous Israeli violist who plays the most extraordinary viola as well, which was made by her Canadian husband. She's had several husbands, I think, but I think the Canadian was number two or number three, and she has this extraordinary sound anyway, and she's a performer of great magnetism.
You've got Jack Liebeck and Michael Collins.
We've got Jack
back.
Returning, Michael returning, Louise Hopkins returning as well, all popular performers up there.
And ever central, the Golden Quartet.
Absolutely. They've been there for, I think, maybe 19 festivals this year.
I think that's about right.
Yeah. Amy Dixon is coming as well, the Australian saxophonist who lives in London, and a charismatic person as well. No, lots and lots of interesting.
We'll get to hear all of them on ABC Classic FM in the next few weeks, really. It's from the end of July through early August. Yes, that's right. Let's make the journey from somehow, I don't know how we're going to do this, from Magnetic Island back to Vienna and Brahms. The Brahms work is also one of those truly loved quintets from the repertoire, something that touches people's hearts. Mm. Is that a work you've lived with for a long time?
It is. It was the first quintet I ever learned. I played it with an American quartet that was resident at the Conservatorium of Music in Brisbane when I was a student there. And had it ready for the Liszt Bartok competition in Budapest, which I went to when I was 18. And so it goes back a long way. And it's a work I've probably played more than any other chamber music. I adore it.
What is it about Brahms? Can we put it in some words for me?
It's funny, isn't it? Because so I adore Brahms, and yet I know many amazing musicians who sneer at Brahms, you know. Benjamin Britten used to, and I believe Tom Addis is a bit like that as well, British composer. And I know that the St. Lawrence Quartet don't play Brahms because their leader thinks it's, you know, appallingly written. So it's fascinating. But Brahms, you know, is so deep emotionally, I think.
It's the harm music again, isn't it? Yes. Not unlike the Mozart in some ways.
Yes, this passionate commitment to everything. Mm. And I think this work too is thinking of Clara Schumann. It's interesting that the second movement opens with C, E flat, and they're the letters for Clara Schumann. So I think she wasn't far ever from his mind in things. It's fascinating. But it's got such fabulous contrast, this piece too, that glorious meditative second movement. And then the scherzo is demonic, you know.
It's a challenge. I need to let you go and get back on stage to perform it. Piers Lane, thank you so much for coming into the break and chatting to us.
Thanks so much, John.